Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is J. Bradford DeLong, who is a professor of economics at the University of California at Berkeley, chair of its political economy major, a research associate of the National Bureau of Economic Research, a visiting scholar at the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco, and he was in the Clinton administration as a deputy assistant secretary of the U.S. Treasury. Brad is also the author of Brad DeLong's Semi-Daily Journal, one of the most popular web blogs devoted to politics and the economy. Brad, welcome to our program.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Where were you born and raised?
Born in Boston. Spent my first 3 years in Cambridge, Massachusetts, while my parents were students. Then we moved to Los Angeles for a couple years, lived in Pasadena. Earliest childhood memory is of one of the few days on which the smog lifted and you could actually see the San Gabriel Mountains from our house.
Did that make you an environmentalist?
Then moved to Washington, D.C. and grew up there.
Mm-hmm. And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
Enormously so. That is, they're both very idealistic people, people who believe that, you know, as Spider-Man says, right, with great power comes great responsibility, and with even minor power and even minor ability to use your head to think about the world comes great responsibility as well.
Mm-hmm. And around the dinner table, what did you talk about? Politics? Economics?
Well, mostly politics and history, I think. Some psychology. My mother's a psychologist. So, say, a bunch of psychology, a bunch of politics, and an awful lot of history.
Mm-hmm. And as a young person, did you have any mentors at school that pointed you in the direction of these issues, reinforced what you were getting from your parents? I'm
certainly very impressed by my 7th and 8th grade social studies teacher, Peter Cohen, at the Sidwell Friends School. There was Joe Wildermuth, the retired CIA agent. Mm-hmm. And a former platoon commander, I think, in Patton's Third Army during World War II, who was an enormous influence as a history teacher in high school.
Mm-hmm. And then where did you do your undergraduate work?
Went to Harvard, mm-hmm. where my parents had gone to Harvard, and two of my grandparents had gone to Harvard, and two of my great-grandparents had gone to Harvard, and I think three of my great-great-grandparents had gone to Harvard.
So you were a legacy, is that what it is?
Definitely a legacy.
And so what were your interests at Harvard, and what did you finally major in?
Oh, you know, when you go off to college, your interests are broad and manifold. And I was interested in pretty much everything, mm-hmm. Perhaps a little bit less interested in the humanities than in the others, mm-hmm. but, say, interested in math, interested in science. Yeah, I actually wound up taking a couple of advanced physics courses with high-powered roommates later on in my career. Wound up my freshman year in Harvard's Math 55, mm-hmm. which is supposed to be one of the most intense math courses on the planet, mm-hmm. And certainly was. But also very much interested in history and was lucky enough to find economics relatively early, I think, in large part because the person teaching my Economics 10 section, Rick Erickson, now at Columbia, was, you know, a superb teacher and an extremely lively mind.
And then on to graduate school at?
Then on to graduate school, still at Harvard.
Mm-hmm. And so was by the time you went to graduate school, you were ready for economics, or was there any doubt still about what you would do your dissertation on?
Well, I was always kind of thinking about being on the border between economics and history. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when your junior year and your senior year, you kind of notice that the people being hired as new economics professors then are 25 years old and they've written one paper and have half written another one and promise that they'll finish their dissertation before they actually show up and start being an assistant professor and sometimes don't. And you notice the people being hired as assistant professors in the history department, they're 40 years old and they've written two books.
I see. Right? So you did the calculations.
So we did the calculations. And perhaps the fact that I was responsive to market forces there demonstrates that I was born to be an economist. Mm-hmm. That if I was born to be a historian, I'd have ignored them.
I see. So what did you do your dissertation on? Or was it a collection of essays?
It's much more a collection of essays. You know, the one that I like most is about the value of Britain's foreign debt and how that shaped British conceptions of whether or not they could afford not to go back on the gold standard in 1925.
So this would be, as a time when the empire was already in decline.
When the empire was in decline, but when there still are enormous assets and liabilities held by Britain abroad. And if you devalue the pound sterling, all of a sudden all of your liabilities in dollars and others go up in value. You acquire a much heavier debt burden. And so not going back on the gold standard, it seemed to be much less of an option than the people like John Maynard Keynes pushing for an abandonment of the gold standard in the 1920s wanted other people to think.
And so what did you find were the forces that made that possible? The choice they made?
Well, the choice they made to go back on the gold standard in 1925 certainly was a mistake, but it was just less of an obvious mistake ex ante than John Maynard Keynes and others arguing for abandonment of the gold standard said.
Now, in economics, were you a student of Larry Summers?
Or? Definitely.
Right.
I think Larry Summers, Jeffrey Williamson, Peter Temin in econometrics, Mark Watson was on my orals committee. Claudia Golden arrived from the University of Pennsylvania and was a very impressive influence.
So tell us what it is that an economist does and what you think are the skills that are required to do that work.
Well, which kind of economist?
Okay, which kind are you?
That's a genuinely hard question. One view is that I'm someone who went off to college and liked it and tried to figure out how never to leave and found a way.
As an economist?
As an economist, to spend my time reading about things and thinking about things and writing things down and telling people about them in all kinds of interesting, in all kinds of different formats and venues. And so I still spend my time looking at things about economics or where the economy meets politics or where the economy meets history that strike me as interesting and trying to learn more about them, trying to think things about them, and then trying to tell people things about them, especially things I think are really interesting. I say, hey, you really ought to know this.
It sounds like you're much more than an economist and really more broadly an intellectual and a public intellectual.
Well, I would like to be an intellectual. There is a certain desire to focus on a relatively narrow area of expertise.
In the academy, within
economics at Berkeley, and also in the world. Yeah, on the grounds that it's a big world. We now have 6.3 billion people. You know, of those 6.3 billion people, how many is it? Approximately 3 billion know how to read, at least, and possibly more. So that means that there are lots of, whenever any question's raised, there's probably somebody who knows much more than I do about it. And if you're thinking of adding to the value of the human conversation, most of the time the best I can do is figure out who is the person who has the most informed view and what can I do to serve as their salesman, right? To rebroadcast what they're already saying to a slightly different or to a very different audience. And some rare occasions, I'm actually the person who knows the most, or at least is willing to argue that I'm one of the ones who are willing knows the most, or I'm willing to have an ego sufficiently large to claim that I'm one of the most. And in that case, I should say what I think. I'm using myself and my own judgments as my authority, as the authority. And it's nice to have a balance between those two. If you're just regurgitating what other people say, who are smarter than you and know more about you, that gets depressing after a while. If you focus down very narrowly on the things on which you know absolutely the most, your mind gets kind of narrow. mm-hmm. because you find yourself thinking about smaller and smaller range of issues.
Mm-hmm. And so this would help us understand why in a lot of your work there is a real sense of the importance of history and of the and how institutions emerged in history.
I mean, I guess I think I would put it slightly differently. You know, I would say that there's an economist's way or a neoclassical economist's way of thinking about mm-hmm. things, in which you look at the social, at the economic, at the social forces, at the situation, and at the pressures, and you say, you know, where in this system are there the points of balance? Right? What is it that could possibly be a situation that is stable in the sense that if something shocks it or moves it a little bit away from that place, it'll come back to normal, and you know that you look for essentially points of equilibrium in a complicated web of forces. Mm-hmm. And most of what an economist does is figuring out how to write down and classify those forces and then figure out what are the points of equilibrium. Mm-hmm. And the other way is to say we could have gotten to any of a huge number of different places. We're here, we're now. You know, how did we get there and say, well, the historical process of development is a very important part of our getting here. Mm-hmm. And these are two very different intellectual bets. Right? The economics bet is that it really doesn't matter where we started from. Mm-hmm. Right? This is the only or one of the very few points of rest of equilibrium of the system. So that if we'd started at any of a wide number of places and if any of a huge number of other different things had happened, we'd still be pretty much here. And in that case, the kind of explanation you want to pursue is one that says that the history is uninteresting. Mm-hmm. What's interesting is that this is a point at which tends to be self-reinforcing. And that's one intellectual bet. The other intellectual bet is that the forces pushing you toward any particular unique outcome are weak, and that looking at the process of historical development is key toward understanding why we happen to be here now. Mm-hmm. And I think I have a bias toward liking the second kind of explanation, mm-hmm. although you know, both are clearly important in the world.
Right, and in your work and on your blog, it would seem that you can play both fields, basically, and wearing one cap informs you when you want to discuss the debate in the other camp.
Oh, you try, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Barry Eichengreen in the office next door has a line that I think he got from Henry Rozovsky, mm-hmm. the former dean of the Harvard faculty, the Japan specialist, who was an assistant professor here at Berkeley in the early 1960s. And Henry's line was that he was walking the tightrope between being a Japan specialist and an economic historian. Mm-hmm. And as long as the Japan specialist talked about what a wonderful economic historian he was, and as long as the economist talked about what a wonderful Japan specialist was, he had it made. Mm-hmm. But if ever the Japan specialist started talking about how superficial his knowledge of Japan was, mm-hmm. and the economist started talking about how, gee, because he was spending so much time studying Japan, he really didn't know that much economics, mm-hmm. then he would be in real, real trouble. And I've kind of felt to maintain the same kind of balance.
Another mm-hmm. theme that I find in your analysis, and I can't claim to have read the large body of your work, but is a sense of the importance of comparative analysis, both you know in history, comparing you know what's going on now back, but also when you're looking at data, saying, well, what exactly you know does this data mean compared to what? I know this is a theme that runs in your critique of the press as it covers economics.
Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure where, I mean, to some degree, this is something that's very common to all right, economists, that you want to say if things were, right, you want to take a situation and then you want to break it apart piece by piece. And you want to say, if this piece were different, right, how would things change? Or how would things be different? And that very much requires that you, A, have a theoretical framework so you can classify forces into supply and demand and others and preferences and technologies and say, okay, we're going to change just this piece, we're going to tweak just this piece and see what happens or what would happen. But then once you've said we have this theoretical classification, we're going to tweak this piece, you then need to figure out how big the effects are, which requires that you find something statistical or anecdotal or comparative you know, to say things are different here, and we can use this to understand the entire complex of the situation, you know, because we actually do have this particular natural experiment in which things were largely the same but a little bit different and look. And there you want to maintain a balance between statistical methods and case study methods. That after all, if you don't have your case studies, you don't know whether the statistics are telling you what you think you are. Mm-hmm. They are. But if you have only case studies, then how do you know your case studies are at all representative?
Mm-hmm. I get a sense in reading some pieces of your work that, here I'm referring to a review you did of the three volumes on Lord Keynes, the importance of using words to make economics persuasive. You refer to Keynes having this ability to talk plainly in the public about issues and write about them. Talk a little about that, because I get the sense that that's what you're trying to do a lot as you pound the press with criticism of the work it's doing. And in your blog, you're trying to explicate economic matters and to eliminate the jargon so people can understand it. Is that fair?
I think it's fair. I think, as always, being a professor, I'd say it's more complicated than
right.
that. One thing I would say is that whenever you serve in the government, you come out appalled at the level of debate and discourse about not just about economics, but about substantive measures of public policy, right, in general, and think that you have a moral obligation, you know, to do something to raise the level of that debate. Hence, Greg Mankiw, when he comes out of his 2 years as chairman of Bush's Council of Economic Advisors, having been beaten up and brutalized largely unfairly by the press on a number of occasions, well, lo and behold, Greg decides he's going to take over Econ 1. Mm-hmm. Actually, at Harvard, they call it Econ 10 mm-hmm. for no good reason, but take over Econ 1 to try to do something on mass education. Mm-hmm. And now Greg Mankiw is out there blogging as well at gregmankiw.blogspot.com. Mm-hmm. And his, I don't think Andrew Samwick at Dartmouth, who I don't think was Greg's chief of staff, I think his title was chief economist at the council, is now over there at Dartmouth, essentially running the equivalent of IIS, mm-hmm. and bringing in outside speakers and others at Dartmouth, and he also is pounding away, you know, mm-hmm. at the keyboard. So one part of it is that you work in government, and you think that the public education role of a professor should have greater importance, and you know, the kind of extending the research frontier and you know, the high formal esoteric discourse should have somewhat less. Mm-hmm. I'd say only somewhat less.
Mm-hmm. Tell us how you wound up in the Clinton administration. You served as Deputy Assistant Secretary in the Treasury Department.
Larry Summers. Right. That is, Larry was going down from, or actually I think by then, over from the World Bank to the Treasury as undersecretary, and he carried a bunch of people down in his train, and I was one of them. Larry persuaded Alicia Minnell, who was an assistant secretary for economic policy, who now runs the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College, you know, to hire me. And we then had a wonderful and, I think, very productive time over the next 3 years.
And what years were those?
1993 through 1995.
Mm-hmm. And what was your job?
Well, there's the Treasury Department. And the Treasury Department has outlying bureaus. It has the IRS. It has the Home Loan Oversight. It has the Mint and Graving and so forth. And then there's the big main Treasury building, which has two jobs, to sell bonds and to raise taxes. Mm-hmm. And so there's a tax policy arm of it, and there's also a domestic finance arm of it, and there's also an international affairs arm of it to try to coordinate international economic policy in one way or another. And then there's this separate group, which is the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Economic Policy, which doesn't really have an operating job. It's not supposed to negotiate treaties about financial service trade or to analyze and propose taxes or to sell bonds and regulate the financial system. It just kind of sits there to do whatever the Secretary of the Treasury wants it to do.
Mm-hmm. And you were there?
And I was and one of Alicia Minnell, who was the Assistant Secretary's three deputies. Mm-hmm. And 1993 to 1995 was an odd time in the U.S. government because, well, back in 1990, perhaps the best thing done, certainly by a Republican in the past 20 years I can think of, is when Richard Darman and Mike Boskin and the other economic policymakers in George H.W. Bush's administration persuaded George H.W. Bush that part of the 1990 deficit reduction package should be something called the Budget Enforcement Act, mm-hmm. which says that anything that moves through Congress has to reduce the deficit, or at least keep the deficit the same. You know, it can't worsen the deficit. What this meant was that every legislative proposal that wanted to spend money had to raise money, which means it had to have a tax component. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden, instead of tax bills being occasional things, there's a tax component to every single thing that is proposed, which means that the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Tax Policy, which I was not in, is all of a sudden overwhelmed with work because they have to come up with, you know, this, we're going to withhold interest, we're going to make banks that are paying interest to people who haven't written their Social Security numbers down on their accounts, we're going to make those banks send that money to the IRS as advance withholding, and that'll raise some money because people who would be evading the taxes now won't because the bank will have collected the taxes in advance, things like that. Mm-hmm. Things that led, you know, say, Assistant Secretary Les Samuel to sometimes come staggering back from Capitol Hill after a very long day saying he was going to change his name to Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Offsetting Receipts rather than for taxes. Yeah. But this means that nothing can be proposed by the administration without the Treasury's tax policy spending a lot of time on it, which means the Treasury Secretary has to decide where it ranks in the hierarchy of things to be done, which meant that all of a sudden, my boss, Alicia Minnell, her opinion on whether something was good policy or not, mm-hmm. you know, was not just an advisory opinion to somebody, the Treasury Secretary, who probably isn't in the room, but was instead potentially decisive because you needed the Treasury Secretary's active interest mm-hmm. and commitment of resources for anything to happen.
And would her decision that the taxing proposal wouldn't work then affect the original legislation?
No, it wouldn't. She wouldn't do the tax part. The secretary would have this huge list of requests from other departments about things that tax policy should work on, and he had to prioritize them. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Secretary Benson and his immediate staff would be sitting there saying which of these things are best for the country.
Mm-hmm. And your work in this process was to generate the thought pieces to help explain?
Well, and to analyze and to say, is this really a good proposal for the country that we should be pushing now? Mm-hmm. Or is this something significantly more dubious, which is worth tax policy's time later, but not right now when we're overwhelmed with stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what surprised you most when you went to Washington taking these economic your skills as an economist? Were you surprised by what you found once you began applying your background and skills to an actual ongoing policy discussion?
I was incredibly surprised by the cynicism of the Republicans, mm-hmm. right? And people did say that there had been a substantial change. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that even the people with whom Benson had been used to working in previous administrations, that people like, say, Pete Domenici and Bob Dole and so forth and Jack Danforth, who had previously been people with whom you could say, you know, you could let your hair down and say what is best for the country in a centrist way, what kind of thing should we try to get through, those conversations were no longer possible. Mm-hmm. Instead, the view was very much that Mr. Clinton has gotten into office with 43% of the vote because Ross Perot drew off our natural vote and defeated the guy who should be president, George H.W. Bush. We're angry. We want to get this back. The way to get this back is to make sure that Clinton's presidency is a failure.
Mm-hmm.
So the first question became not, is this something that's good for the country? But is this something that if it passes will make Clinton's presidency look less like a failure?
Mm-hmm.
This is out of this you get such things as William Kristol's memo saying that health care reform should be opposed sight unseen.
Mm-hmm.
And that the worst thing of all would be that if the Democrats propose a health policy reform that's good for the country and it then passes. Because then the Democrats and Clinton will get credit for doing something good for the country. We can't have that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, better a continuation of the current health care mess.
Mm-hmm.
Extraordinarily wasteful, extraordinarily ineffective at getting coverage to poorer Americans than something that actually makes the country better off if the Democrats kind of benefit from it.
So what you're suggesting is that it didn't start necessarily with ideological conflict in the sense of a conservative revolution that wanted to limit the goal of government, but rather it was about partisanship and who won and who didn't win.
Yeah, see, it seems extraordinarily partisan to me in 93 and 94, even before the Gingrich victory. And, of course, the Gingrich victory in 94 reinforces that and I think further sends the Republican Party off into the Gamma Quadrant. You know, that is really odd that kind of when I went down to the Treasury, I very much thought of myself as part of the sensible bipartisan center. Kind of like Paul Krugman once thought of himself as part of the sensible bipartisan center. And actually dealing with, or going along in the train of the Assistant Secretary for Legislative Affairs and others of Benson's senior staff in 93-95 really changed that. Paul Krugman, on the other hand, stayed symmetrically and ruthlessly bipartisan throughout the 90s, with this attack on right-wing supply-siders being followed by that attack on left-wing protectionists in a carefully measured tit-for-tat. And he only joined the shrill kind of in 2000 or so when he said, wait a minute, this isn't the Republican Party that I thought it had been or that I had been used to.
It's interesting that you bring this up because I looked at your paper analyzing the financial crisis of the late 90s and how the Clinton administration responded. And in the beginning, you say you're examining analytically the Clinton administration, and you say of it, its own political failures destroyed the administration's ability to make large moves in domestic policy. You're now, and then you go on to talk about the international. But does that description there go back to what you were just talking about? In other words, what were the political failures that it was perceived as a government that shouldn't have won the election, and it was really about this partisan politics, or was it things that they did actually that led to failure?
Well, it was the collapse of Democratic congressional power in 1994.
Yeah.
The fact that then you're confronted with kind of Gingrich and Dole. And so as a result, have a very hard time getting things done. Plus, when you do get things done, well, like, say, the peso rescue package, the rescue of the Mexican peso and the restriction of the 1994-1995 financial crisis in Mexico to a kind of one-year short but sharp recession rather than a 3 or 4 year depression. That was something that the Clinton administration did that it should be very proud of, and in fact that the senior Republicans wanted done. There's this letter from the Democratic chiefs, right, from Mitchell and I think Gephardt, and also from the Republican chiefs, from Dole and Gingrich, saying we have no objections if you, the Treasury, rescue Mexico by using the exchange stabilization fund to support the peso now. But of course, once that goes forward, Dole grabs Senator Alphonse D'Amato and says, well, why don't you see if you can stir up some dirt so that in case the Mexican peso rescue goes sour somehow, we can blame the Democrats. Mm-hmm. And so you have things like stories in the Washington Post in the summer of 1995 written by Clay Chandler based on leaks from D'Amato office, some saying such things as Larry Summers was warned in the start of 1994 mm-hmm. that Mexico was headed for a disaster and he ignored the warnings of the career staff, et cetera, et cetera. Things that were substantially untrue that Al D'Amato didn't think were untrue or didn't think were true. That Clay Chandler of the Washington Post, God knows, but that were there to try to, say, position the Republican Party to benefit from anything that went wrong. And one consequence of that was that the Treasury then found itself hamstrung in 1997 and 98, prohibited by legislation from actually doing any much constructive to help the East Asian crisis when it first struck. Mm-hmm. And that's what that's a reference to, in a kind of cryptic and oblique way.
Mm-hmm. So what you're saying, and you know, I know you've written on the 1947 mm-hmm. Employment Act, and I guess what you're saying is that in those days there was a center. I'm reading this into our discussion here, so that you actually could then build institutions that made a difference. But now in this recent period, you're saying there's a kind of a partisan breakdown that makes that impossible. And even if you go along with a deal, you're building the case for undercutting the next kind of intervention.
Well, for this, I think you should get Poole and Rosenthal out here from Princeton mm-hmm. because they have a political science book on this. Mm-hmm. And it's not an issue that I thoroughly understand. You know, all I know is a kind of worm's eye, apparatchik's eye view, which was that even in 1993-94, it was nearly impossible to build bipartisan coalitions from the center out. Instead, if you were a Democrat, you had to start from the left and hope that you could then somehow get enough stuff together. And indeed, most of the time you failed. And most coalitions were built from the right out. And that's one reason I think we're in substantial or much more trouble than we have to be right now. Why this is so is much less clear. Mm-hmm. One theory is that from 1865 until about sometime between 1930 and 1960, it varies. There are a lot of relatively liberal people in the North who are going to vote Republican because Lincoln freed the slaves. And from 1865 until sometime later, maybe 1990 or so, there are lots of people in the South who are conservative but are going to vote Democrat because Lincoln freed the slaves. Mm-hmm. Thus, the Democratic Party is by and large an alliance of northern liberals and southern conservatives, and the Republican Party is largely an alliance of southern liberals and some northern conservatives, but also some northern liberals too, right, who remember that Lincoln freed the slaves. And so the lines of organizational cleavage aren't the lines of partisan, or aren't the lines of ideological cleavage, and thus there's relatively little space for high partisan cleavage. Mm-hmm. Now, there are some anomalies, like between 1933 and 1963 or so. A relatively liberal Democratic Party finds itself sometimes hamstrung in the House and Senate because so many of the senior conservative or senior chairs are relatively conservative Democrats from the South with lots of seniority. And so you can argue that from 33 to 1963 or so, the actual Congress as it worked, as it voted, was much more conservative than the country because of this partisan anomaly. And then from 1963 to 1993, you have a Congress where the levers of committee chairmanships are controlled by northern liberals, And you have a Congress that's somewhat to the left of the country as a whole. But you do have a situation in which you can have a working majority, conservative working majority, even if you don't have a conservative partisan majority for the Republicans. And you can have a liberal working majority that's bigger, or even if you don't have a liberal organizational majority. You know, the last or the biggest gasp of this is that Lyndon Johnson got a larger share of Republican senators than Democratic senators to vote for the Civil Rights Act of 1964, a Republican position that was then immediately repudiated by Barry Goldwater as its standard bearer. But you know, there it was. Mm-hmm. And that this created the American government that we are used to. And all of that changed in 1994, when the memory of the Civil War finally died, as far as American politics was concerned. And the Republican Party became something very strange and very Southern dominated. The other view is that you know, there are still deeper causes having to do with how great income inequality is in America, and thus whether it's truly worthwhile for the rich to mount a full court press to oppose social democracy in all of its forms. Mm-hmm. And that there you have a strikingly partisan Congress before 1929, the system we were used to from 29 to 1990, and then a strikingly partisan Congress again. And that it's really a fight over the distribution of wealth going on that makes us more of what we used to think of as a Latin American style country, either before 1929 or today, than the middle class kind of consensus Congress in between. These are issues that are above my pay grade as a bureaucrat.
Yeah.
And that also are outside any place where I can claim to have an area of substantive mm-hmm. expertise. And so the right thing for me to do is probably to shut up, to point to Poole and Rosenthal and company at Princeton as the experts on this, and to ask you to have them on Conversations with History.
And so I will do that. But now I will move to an area where you have expertise. Looking back, I think you have some criticism of the way the Clinton administration and its international economic policy thought that liberalization would take care of things on its own, that the process would, in fact, address problems like inequality in the world and not have to deal with the kind of financial crisis that emerged. They in essence, forgot, you know, some truths in economics that we all knew.
Well, not sure forgot, but rather decided to run some risks and perhaps understated others. Well, perhaps the most gross example of this is indeed something that was picked up by Alphonse D'Amato's staff when they were overseeing the Treasury and then leaked in an extremely misleading way to the Washington Post. The question of what's going to happen in the aftermath of the ratification of NAFTA, of the North American Free Trade Agreement. And, you know, NAFTA does two things. First, it really doesn't lower tariffs from between on Mexican imports into the United States. Mexican imports into the United States were very low tariff anyway. What NAFTA does do is it guarantees that the U.S. won't raise tariffs on imports from Mexico. It gives Mexico guaranteed tariff-free access to the largest consumer market in the world. And so every manufacturing business that's wondering where to locate around the world, after NAFTA, if they want to serve the U.S. market, they can be confident that no matter what happens to American domestic politics, you won't get a big tariff or a quota slammed down on you if you're producing in Mexico. And on the other side, what NAFTA does is NAFTA guarantees as much as it can that Mexico will respect the property of northern corporations that are investing in it. That if you're thinking of building a factory in Mexico, then you don't have to worry that the government will find some way to confiscate it once it's there and once it's up and running. And the hope was that this would give a big positive push to Mexican development. that all of a sudden you make Mexico a much more attractive place for global finance to flow to, because you have guaranteed tariff-free access to the largest consumer market in the world, and because people from outside investing in Mexico and people from inside investing in Mexico now have a bunch of additional protections of their property. And so the hope was that this would cause an industrial boom in Mexico that would raise wages in Mexico substantially and diminish immigration into the United States as people moving to, you know, Monterrey and Ciudad Juarez and, you know, Tijuana and Mexico City would have a bunch of better opportunities in Mexico. You know, and then Mexico needed a country still growing at 2.5% per year, kind of needs all the jobs it can get. Mm-hmm. And that thus the best road for Mexico forward in the 1990s was this kind of neoliberal development, integrate with the world economy, try to find your niche in the International Division of Labor, and go for it. And NAFTA was an important part of allowing, right, the Mexican government, the then not very democratic Mexican government, to exercise this strategy. And of course, two things went wrong, things that went wrong that we didn't see. And the first of which was, the first of this was that not only does NAFTA mean that American companies can safely invest in Mexico, it also opens up capital flows from Mexico to the United States. So that if you're a rich Mexican in Mexico City, and if you're kind of worried about an uncertain political future, wouldn't it be nice to have a very large account at Citigroup? Just in case something bad happens politically or tax-wise, or even better, a very large bank account in the Cayman Islands. Wouldn't it be nice to be able to do this easily? And so the aftermath of NAFTA sees not only an inward flow of investment from the U.S. to Mexico, as companies think, gee, maybe Mexico's a good place to produce, it also sees an outward flow of wealth from Mexico to the United States and elsewhere, as people in Mexico say, gee, now we should put some of our financial eggs in other baskets. And so while I had been expecting NAFTA to see a strengthening of the peso, as you have this inflow of capital looking for pesos so they can start building up Mexico's industrial infrastructure, that was matched and in fact outweighed by an outflow, a portfolio outflow by Mexicans seeking to diversify. And so NAFTA was followed not by a strengthening but a weakening of the peso, and the catastrophic crisis of 1994-95, which I certainly had not foreseen, since I had been looking only at the first inflow and not at the magnitude of the second outflow. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that the system was more complicated and also produces significantly larger swings in income distribution than we had thought was definitely something that if we had to go back again and do it over, we certainly would want to guard against much more.
Mm-hmm. Recently, Alan Greenspan has come out with his book, The Age of Turbulence, and mm-hmm. and you've talked about it on your blog and in some of the press articles in the LA Times, for example. And I believe that what you're saying is that in looking at Greenspan, you have to recognize that he was in some ways partisan, that he was a follower of Ayn Rand. And with both of those things, he was also a very competent technocrat with regard to monetary matters. Mm-hmm. What I'm curious about is, does that analysis also apply to the people who came to Washington in the Clinton administration on the other side? In other words, they all come with very high technical competence, but are they tied to certain ideas that, as they are applied in a very complex world, that things are more complicated than they thought? I'm talking here about Larry Summers, Rubin, and so on. Or was Greenspan an example, one of a kind?
I think Alan Greenspan is one of a kind.
Okay.
If only because there are relatively few Randites, right, in the world today.
Right. Well, I assume,
Ayn Rand never had all that many followers. Mm-hmm. And Alan Greenspan was and is certainly one. which does very much put him out on the hyper-libertarian end of the American political spectrum. Mm-hmm. You know, that, I mean, as I understand it, Greenspan is someone who genuinely thinks that the federal government is about five times as large as it should be. You know, that we should have maybe a third the army that we do, and maybe not even the post office. Maybe that should be privatized as well. And that a much smaller government would see a richer and freer America, right, as well. And he believes that at a deep and committed level, which means that whenever possible, he is going to be pushing to shrink the size of the state, you know, to offload things that the government does onto other forms of activity, onto charity or onto the private market, simply because he believes the government is inherently not very competent, you know, and likely to become quite oppressive. And, you know, that's much more than almost anyone else in America would say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, other people, even Republicans, think that the government has a big role to play in retirement insurance income, in unemployment insurance, you know, in health policy, as well as in national defense and public order. And Greenspan, in his ideal world, things would be significantly different. Nevertheless, Greenspan is, you know, an incredibly good central banker, right? Incredibly competent at the role he managed to find for himself, and substantially public-spirited as well.
Yeah.
That is, deeply concerned not just about the narrow mandate of the Fed to maintain price stability, but also the other tasks, you know, to try to get as close as possible to full employment and rapid economic growth, and to try to distribute that economic growth, you know, as widely as possible. And there is this great puzzle that someone who is a disciple of the government-hating Ayn Rand and of the central planning-hating Ayn Rand can nevertheless serve 18 years as the closest thing to a global economic central planner the world has ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
And do so in a way that, well, say, two of Greenspan's big policy preferences. Where first he decided in the mid-1990s to take a risk by not raising interest rates further at a time when virtually everyone else in the Federal Reserve thought they should be raised further, in order to see whether the computer revolution was a real important thing, and thus to try to get the unemployment rate down by an extra percentage point or so, above and beyond what his fellows had thought was sustainable. Because maybe the computer revolution was a big deal, and maybe as a result the sustainable level of employment without inflation had fallen, and maybe here he could get an extra 1.3 million people American jobs over the next several years, you know, without winding up with a bad stagflationary outcome. And virtually nobody else at the Federal Reserve wanted to take that risk. They all said the risks were too high, right? Dangers were too high. What if we mess up? Arthur Burns messed up big time in the 1970s. We really don't want to go back there again. You know, Greenspan did, and by force of personality and the fact that he was sitting in the chairman's seat, you know, seems to have largely overridden the institution in such a way that, yes, that there were about 1.3 million Americans in each year from 1997 to 2000, you know, who had jobs, who would not have had jobs had Alan Greenspan not been willing to override the rest of the committee, largely override the rest of the committee, and embark on this course. You know, and that's a very good thing to have done, to have had judgment good enough and to be willing to say that I know that the chairman of the Federal Reserve is supposed to be the tool of Wall Street and the guardian of price stability. But let's take a little risk for somewhat higher inflation if it turns out wrong. But, you know, an extra 5.2 million person years of guys who have jobs rather than sitting around twiddling their thumbs on the other. You know, that's, you know, about 2 million people who owe Alan Greenspan, right, quite a lot. And that's an accomplishment which definitely should not be taken away from him. And the second thing, something that you find in his book in the very last pages of it, he says that he thinks that the American economic system is wonderful, that it's a mixed economy, government spending perhaps 35-40% of national product. He thinks it would be stronger if it were much more of a market economy, but he thinks it's wonderful. But he says it's politically sustainable only as long as people believe that the way income is distributed and is not too unfair, and people are losing that belief. Hence, what the United States should do is it should open up its borders to every well-trained and well-educated person anywhere in the world, have a flood of 20 or 30 million immigrants with engineering master's degrees and other advanced technical and professional qualifications. And this will put downward pressure on the wages of the upper class and the upper middle class. They'll be taking less. But the fact that they're taking less will leave more for the working class and the lower middle class, and their wages will get bit up. And so in a relatively short period of time, Greenspan says, you'll have a much more equal income distribution and also a much more cosmopolitan country as we add 30 million well-trained and smart people coming in from outside. And that if he could do one thing in the short and medium term in American policy, right, this is what he'd do. And that's something that is definitely not to the interest of America's upper class right now. It's an enormous benefit to the immigrants who would come, yes, and it's an enormous, enormous benefit to the people in the strata that haven't been gotten very much out of the economic advances of the past generation. But it's also something that indicates a more complicated personality than simply the disciple of Ayn Rand with her kind of everyone should be in their own boat and care only about themselves view of moral philosophy.
That leads me to my last question, and we don't have a lot of time left. Looking back on your career, what have you learned from kind of this mixing of, you know, an academic discipline, economics, with a concern about public discourse, but at the same time trying to combine that with experience in government where the ideas make a difference? Are there any lessons from students there in your career?
Oh, lessons. I'll have to think about that. I mean, the lesson that strikes me is that I've been incredibly lucky. Yeah, that I've managed to find something that I like doing every single day. And the University of California is willing to pay me handsomely for it and to give me enormous freedom to decide how exactly I want to spend my time and what I want to do. And as an economist, we at UC like to grouse, right? We're paid maybe $30,000 a year less than our fellow economists at private universities of equivalent rank elsewhere in the country. And we're paid God knows how much less than the people at the business school. And, this is unfair. Economists should clearly make as much as people in the finance group at the business school, et cetera, et cetera. But aside from deliberately working ourselves into a state of frenzy at our unnatural relative deprivation, the modern American university is an extraordinarily wonderful environment for someone like me, and I ought to spend most of my time being much more grateful than I am that the Regents of the University of California and company have allowed me to have this job. So let me thank Mr. Blum and the others for keeping this organization going, because it has been of absolutely wonderful benefit to me. And I hope that what I'm able to contribute makes it of benefit to the people of California and the world as well.
Brad, on that note, I want to thank you, and I want to recommend to our audience your blog, which is Brad DeLong Semi-Daily Journal, because you continue the dialogue there about very academic issues, but also help us understand how they are part of the public dialogue. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.